leaving school entirely. This leftist academic world is a little too much for me. The reason I am contacting you is because, as an honors cognitive student, part of my requirement is to complete 12 credits of research. However, because of purely political reasons, I am apparently a violent, misogynist, racist Trump supporter. I have not only lost my job at a very prestigious behavioral neuroscience laboratory at Redacted, but my name has been removed from a publication on research I personally conducted, and the lead researcher has told me he would never work with me ever again. I very much appreciate your courage to fight the cancer that is taking over American academia. People like me feel cheated at their attempt to pursue a tenure-track career. It only takes a glimpse at the job offerings that the Modern Languages Association publishes each year to understand that what is expected from recent graduates like me is political activism, and I refuse to mix that with my academic interests. I will save you my long stories of dealing and suffering career-wise from politically correct nonsense from the directions of feminism, gender ideology, trans extremism, and Islamophilia. I am trying to keep a lid on things for now, as my wife is a very promising academic but hasn't secured a position yet. I know if I start voicing my thoughts and arguments on social media, she'd be completely shut out of the academy. As a fellow professor who has been frustrated by the discourse within academia on issues such as political correctness, moral relativism, and social justice, I'd like to thank you for speaking up the way you have been from within academia. I have nevertheless been frustrated by the conformism and groupthink I see and hear around me. I see otherwise very reasonable and capable people abandoning reason and cowing to the narrative of the regressive left on many social issues. When I told this professor to engage and debate these issues openly, the professor replied, "These are all things which I would like to get involved in once the tenure decision is behind me, about 1 year to go. As upsetting as it is, one fears expressing unpopular social ideas prior to tenure. In the meantime, please keep fighting the good fight for freedom of speech and against thought policing and orthodoxy." These are not emails sent to me from dissidents in North Korea, Yemen, or the former Soviet Union. Ideological Stalinism is the daily reality on North American college campuses. Any freedom-loving person should be appalled by this, and yet most academics yawn in complicit apathy and cowardly inaction. They are too worried about their selfish careerist considerations to weigh in on these matters. They are happy to tell me privately that they support my efforts, but please, Dr. Saad, don't share my name. I don't want people to know that I share your views. Why should people in a free country be afraid of saying what they believe? Think about that, and you will know the direction that the, quote, progressives want to take us. Free speech equals Nazism? On August 22, 2017, Ryerson University was scheduled to host an event titled "The Stifling of Free Speech on University Campuses," organized by Sarina Singh, a Sikh woman of color, to use the parlance of social justice warriors. Ms. Singh worked for 2 decades as a social worker until she decided to quit her occupation, as she could no longer handle the pernicious, anti-science, illiberal progressive dogma that had infested her field. 4 speakers were scheduled for the event: Dr. Jordan Peterson, Dr. Oren Amate, a clinical psychologist and lecturer at Ryerson University, Faith Goldie, a somewhat polarizing journalist, and me. I was going to speak about how freedom of speech is the source from which all our freedoms flow. I was also planning on reading first-person testimonies of students and professors terrorized by the thought police on their campuses. Are you able to guess what transpired next? In a twist of Orwellian irony, an Antifa-like outfit shut down the event. Rather than standing up to these intellectual terrorists and enemies of reason, Ryerson University cited security concerns as their justification for canceling an event meant to highlight the importance of free speech on university campuses. The lunacy does not end there. The organizers of the shutdown had created a Facebook page with a Nazi swastika, declaring that they did not tolerate Nazis, white supremacists, and anti-Semites in, quote, their city. They added Islamophobes and transphobes for good measure. I am an olive-skinned Lebanese Jew who escaped execution in Lebanon, and yet I am apparently an anti-Semitic Nazi. Dr. Amite is Jewish, and his family suffered during the Holocaust. He is married to a Japanese woman, and he has an adopted black gay brother. What a racist, transphobic Nazi! Our identities and personal histories did not cause these violators of human dignity to take stock. They simply doubled down on their positions. We were Nazi peddlers of hate. This recent debacle is hardly an isolated event. The American-based Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, documented 192 disinvitation efforts, attempts to stop invited speakers at American universities for the period 2000 to 2014. And this dreadful pattern is growing. The, quote, success rate of such attempts varied between 38% and 44%, a truly breathtaking affront to the First Amendment of the American Constitution. Disinvitation efforts are nearly three times more likely to take place if the, quote, offending speaker is seen as belonging on the political right. Since the 2014 report was released, there have been many more leftist-led disinvitations and disruptions of a broad range of speakers, including former CIA Director John Brennan at the University of Pennsylvania, the political scientist Charles Murray at Middlebury College, equity feminist Christina Hoff Summers at Lewis and Clark College, feminist icon Camille Paglia at the University of the Arts, and Nobel laureate James Watson at New York University and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The status of freedom of speech on Canadian universities is hardly better. The Justice Center for Constitutional Freedom's 2017 Campus Freedom Index evaluated the health of free speech at 60 Canadian universities along four variables: 1, university policies; 2, university practices; 3, student union policies; and 4, student union practices, using the grades A, B, C, D, and F. Of 240 possible grades, 60 universities times 4 grades per university, Canadian universities garnered 6 A's and 38 F's. American and Canadian universities are hardly bastions of free speech. Instead, they are echo chambers for the left. Deviate from the herd at your peril. I believe in free speech, but it is now part of the West's zeitgeist that we should never utter anything that might offend, anger, or insult anyone who is a, quote, minority or a, quote, progressive. This was not always the case. The 1988 Salman Rushdie affair was a landmark in this new era of restricted speech. When his book, The Satanic Verses, was released, it immediately drew the ire of many members of the Ummah, the global Islamic community, who viewed it as blasphemous to their religion and prophet. Ayatollah Khomeini, then the supreme leader of Iran, issued a death sentence against Rushdie. Rushdie was forced to live under police protection. The novelist made a guest appearance on Larry David's highly popular television series Curb Your Enthusiasm, mocking his own predicament by explaining why women are keen on having sex with a globally wanted man. Two passages from an article Rushdie wrote in 2005 make the succinct case for freedom of speech. The idea that any kind of free society can be constructed in which people will never be offended or insulted, or in which they have the right to call on the law to defend them against being offended or insulted, is absurd. Moreover, the moment you say that an idea system is sacred, whether it's a religious belief system or a secular ideology, the moment you declare a set of ideas to be immune from criticism, satire, derision, or contempt, freedom of thought becomes impossible. Progressives consider it laudable to criticize, mock, or insult all religious beliefs, except for the one untouchable faith. To attack Islam in the West is Islamophobic, racist, and bigoted. If a Republican politician says he believes homosexuality is wrong because of his Christian faith, progressives are quick to express their outrage and horror and will organize protests accordingly. If ISIS members throw gay men off rooftops based on specific fatwas, the same progressives are deafeningly silent. After all, who are we to criticize the practices of the noble religion? It is apparently arrogant cultural imperialism to impose our values onto others, especially if they are members of the untouchable faith. In 2005, the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten published 12 cartoons that caricatured Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. Violence erupted around the world, resulting in the deaths of around 200 individuals. Several years later, Jutta Clausen authored a book on the controversy titled The Cartoons That Shook the World. The publisher, Yale University Press, decided against publishing the caricatures in a book about the caricatures. Most major media outlets were equally cowardly and refrained from printing the cartoons on their platforms. Nearly 10 years later, the Charlie Hebdo massacre occurred in Paris. This satirical magazine had blasphemed against Islam, and so Muslim terrorists attacked its employees, brutally massacring 12 people and seriously injuring several others. Christianity is repeatedly criticized and mocked, and yet Christians do not respond with such violence or anything like it. In 1987, Andre Serrano's photo titled Piss Christ, depicting a crucifix in the photographer's urine, won an award that was partly sponsored by the National Endowment of the Arts, an agency of the United States government. Many Christians were clearly upset by it, but they did not lead violent protests. In a 2009 episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David, co-creator of Seinfeld, visits the home of an employee and, while using the bathroom, inadvertently splashes urine on an image of Jesus Christ in the restroom. The employee, unaware of David's mishap, interprets it as a divine tear. It is difficult to imagine a more offensive storyline to the more than 2 billion Christians in the world, and yet no one was killed as a retaliation against this puerile humor. The Austrian film Paradise Faith featured a woman masturbating with a crucifix, and yet it won a jury prize at the 2012 Venice Film Festival. The Book of Mormon is a highly successful musical that makes fun of various practices of the Mormon religion. It has won a Tony Award and has grossed more than $500 million on Broadway alone. And yet no Mormon explosion of anger and violence has taken place. Contrast these tame reactions to what happened in 2012, when an ineptly produced short movie titled Innocence of Muslims triggered mass protests in many countries, resulting in more than 50 deaths, and a death fatwa being issued on the film's producer, director, and actors. There was even a debate within the upper echelon of the United States government as to whether the 2012 attack on an American compound in Benghazi, Libya, resulting in the death of 4 Americans, including a U.S. ambassador, was a violent response to the film. Holocaust deniers engage in perhaps the most egregious form of offensive speech. They constitute an affront to human decency as they reject the well-documented historical fact that millions of Jews were systematically exterminated. Of all possible falsehoods, the denial of the Holocaust is an unrivaled murder of the truth. And yet I, a Jewish man who escaped religious persecution in Lebanon, support the right of Holocaust deniers to spew their vile and inhumane garbage. It is difficult to imagine a greater manifestation of what it means to be a free speech absolutist. If you truly understand the meaning of free speech, then you must agree with the following. There is simply no better alternative than to allow those with unpopular views to express them and to allow those wishing to hear them to do so. The "I believe in free speech, but" crowd violates the foundational ethos of what it means to have free speech. Usually what comes after the "but" is an appeal to refrain from hurting people's sensibilities and feelings. The general idea is that we must weigh our freedom of speech against the right of others to not be offended. No. Freedom of speech is precisely meant to protect the most obnoxious, offensive, and disgusting speech. It does not exist to ensure that you only levy beautiful compliments at me. Occasionally being offended is the price that one pays for living in a truly free society. Your feelings might get hurt. Grow a pair and move on. Needless to say, being a free speech absolutist comes with the usual provisos, including that screaming fire in a theater, inciting violence against others, and engaging in defamatory and libelous discourse are not protected speech. But the opponents of free speech are trying to contort these common sense restrictions to suit their own purposes. One of the ways that the West is losing its will to fight for freedom of speech is by enacting hate speech laws. Several prominent European figures have been prosecuted under the broad shoulders of hate speech, including the Dutch parliamentarian Geert Wilders, mentioned earlier, the president of the International Free Press Society, Lars Hedegaard, and Austrian activist Elisabeth Sabadich-Wolf. In all these cases, these individuals and many others got into legal trouble for criticizing Islam. Under the watch of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Canadian parliamentarian Iqra Khalid introduced Motion 103, which originally stemmed from E-411, a petition to the House of Commons, initiated by Samer Majoub. Both the petition and the motion, neither of which is a law, sought to combat Islamophobia, which is a nonsensical concept. In a free society, people have every right to mock, condemn, criticize, despise, and fear any ideology. Perhaps the most chilling attempt to quell the right of individuals to criticize religions, and by that I mean one particular religion, has come from the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, composed of 56 countries and the Palestinian territories. They constitute the largest voting bloc of the United Nations, and as such it is perhaps not surprising that Israel receives far more official UN condemnations than all brutal regimes in the world combined. The OIC has repeatedly attempted to get Western nations to adopt the Cairo Declaration on Human Rights in Islam, which would oblige signatory nations to punish anyone who criticizes Islam. This repeated quest to impose Sharia-like restrictions on free speech regarding Islam is receiving a sympathetic hearing in the West, including from former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and former President Barack Obama, who famously stated in an address to the United Nations Assembly that, quote, "the future must not belong to those who slander the Prophet of Islam." On the contrary, Mr. President, the future must belong to those who criticize, mock, ridicule, and satirize all prophets, ideas, religions, and ideologies. Satire as the surgeon's scalpel. Wherever there is objective truth, there is satire. Wyndham Lewis. How much truth is contained in something can be best determined by making it thoroughly laughable and then watching to see how much joking around it can take. For truth is a matter that can stand mockery, that is freshened by any ironic gesture directed at it. Whatever cannot stand satire is false. Peter Sloterdijk. Ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. Ideas must be distinct before reason can act upon them. Thomas Jefferson. Satire is a strategy I frequently employ to critique idea pathogens. To make it effective, as Mary Wortley Montagu said, satire should, like a polished razor keen, wound with a touch that's scarcely felt or seen. This is precisely why totalitarian rulers have always outlawed satire directed at them and their ideologies. If an idea is veridical, it should be anti-fragile. It should be capable of withstanding ironic, satirical, and sarcastic attacks. If it is too brittle to do so, it is undoubtedly a falsehood. Satirists have recognized this for millennia, as evidenced by the works of Horace, Aristophanes, Juvenal, Lucian of Samosata, Al-Ma'ari, Voltaire, Francois Rabelais, Jonathan Swift, Oscar Wilde, Mark Twain, Ambrose Bierce, and George Orwell. I would also include comedians like Lenny Bruce and George Carlin, the television show South Park, and magazines like Mad and Charlie Hebdo. On July 16, 2018, the noted evolutionary scientist and atheist Richard Dawkins tweeted, "Listening to the lovely bells of Winchester, one of our great medieval cathedrals, so much nicer than the aggressive-sounding Allahu Akbar, or is that just my cultural upbringing?" I replied, "Dear Richard, Arabic is my mother tongue. When properly translated, Allahu Akbar means we love all people but hold a special fondness for Jews, women, and gays. Don't worry, it's a message of love, tolerance, and liberalism." Newsweek, initially not getting the joke, said I had criticized Dawkins for his bigotry, before eventually realizing that I had been sarcastic. My satirical powers, however, reached all the way to Pakistan, where I managed to bamboozle the Express Tribune in an article written to condemn Dawkins' Islamophobia. They deleted any mention of me and my tweet when they realized that I had tweeted in jest. At times, my satire is so powerful that it fools even those who have followed me on Twitter for a while. Donald Trump Jr. had weighed in on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's unfortunate use of the term concentration camps in reference to the detention centers at the U.S. border with Mexico. Specifically, he posted a tweet that included clips from actual Holocaust survivors to drive home the point that her comparison was foolish, if not grotesque. In my attempt to satirize the left's routine false equivalence between their opponents and Nazis, I replied to Trump Jr.'s tweet as follows. "No way, Donald. At AOC is a woman of color in Trump's MAGA country. She faces much greater daily threats than those Holocaust survivors ever did." The average three-day-old pigeon should be able to pick up such outlandishly obvious satire. Apparently, Charlie Kirk, a conservative pundit and founder of Turning Point USA, did not receive the memo. He tweeted, "Wow. At God Saad, a professor who is teaching youth in Canada at the John Molson School of Business, says that at AOC is in more danger than Holocaust survivors ever were. This is who is teaching our children. This is the face of liberal education. Sick. RT. I ended up receiving innumerable angry tweets from people, all of whom were apparently immune to the powers of satire. Note that Kirk behaved like a leftist social justice warrior. He was outraged and so mobilized an e-mob against me and took aim at the school where I teach. He eventually deleted his tweet, though without offering me an apology. But perhaps my greatest satirical ruse occurred when PJ Media listed one of my quotes amongst its 20 worst quotes of 2018. Now that is an accomplishment of the highest order. Here is the quote. "To all noble undocumented immigrants, we apologize for our bigotry and racism. It is Nazism to not allow you to vote in our elections. After all, national borders is Nazism. Nationhood is Nazism. In a just world, everyone should get to vote in any district. Hashtag, we apologize." I contacted the author of the piece, who apparently was unable to distinguish political satire from real political lunacy, and he eventually removed me from his, quote, worst quotes list. The takeaway point is this. Free societies do not recoil at the power of satire. They recognize that all beliefs and ideologies are fair game. Once we delimit what can be satirized, we are no longer living in a free society. Identity politics are antithetical to science. In fall 2018, I organized and hosted a symposium on evolutionary consumption at my university. A few days prior to the symposium, I received an email from a female colleague in another department at my university, telling me she could not attend, and then chastising me for my, quote, oversight of not including more women speakers. Here is my reply. "Many thanks for your email. I am sorry that you won't be able to make it. As to your point, I do not subscribe to identity politics and certainly not in science. If the symposium at hand necessitated that most speakers be women, so be it. If in this case the number of male to female speakers is not, quote, balanced, so be it. I did invite another female speaker, but she was unavailable. I did not choose my speakers as a function of whether they ovulate or not. I chose them based on their fit with the topic at hand, their availability, etc. The U.S. government released data across 5 races and 4 educational attainment levels: associate's degree, bachelor's, master's, and doctorate. As such, there were 20 cells to analyze. In every single cell, women outnumbered men. Are you going to push for greater gender parity across the cells because it is difficult to imagine a more, quote, biased reality? I should add that we do not know whether any of the male speakers self-identify as women, so perhaps the gender parity is more balanced than might first appear. In any case, thank you for writing in. I hope that we'll have a chance to interact again. I have yet to receive a reply from my colleague. Of note, I visited her university website and saw that she had posted a photo of herself with her 9 lab members, all of whom were women. Lest you think that this incident is an outlier, Joe Rogan was recently chastised by the progressive organization Media Matters for having many more male guests than female ones. The Canadian government's allocation of endowed research chairs at Canadian universities, known as Canada Research Chairs, must now abide by an Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Action Plan that ensures that more, quote, women, Indigenous peoples, persons with disabilities, and members of visible minorities are appointed as chairholders. Universities that do not abide by this action plan will have funding withheld. Even the Nobel Prize has been infected with this destructive mindset. An article published in Nature, one of 2 premier science journals, chastised the Nobel Committee for the gender disparity in science laureates, 3% of whom have been women, and went on to add that the great majority of winners have operated in Western countries. The recognition of scientific excellence ought to be driven by meritocratic ideals, and yet it is increasingly contaminated by identity politics. In April 2017, the inaugural March for Science rally was held across hundreds of cities around the world to reaffirm the importance of science, in part as a response to Donald Trump's supposed anti-science agenda. On January 30, 2017, I visited a key mobilizing website for the event and found this mission statement. At the March for Science, we are committed to centralizing, highlighting, standing in solidarity with, and acting as accomplices with Black, Latinx, Asian, and Pacific Islander, Indigenous, non-Christian, women, people with disabilities, poor, gay, lesbian, bisexual, queer, trans, non-binary, agender, and intersex scientists and science advocates. We must work to make science available to everyone, and encouraging individuals of all backgrounds to pursue science careers, especially in advanced degrees and positions. A diverse group of scientists produces increasingly diverse research, which broadens, strengthens, and enriches scientific inquiry, and therefore our understanding of the world. If you are a white, Christian, heterosexual male scientist, tough luck, buddy. Following a wave of criticism from several high-profile academics, including the Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker and yours truly, the latter statement was revised, albeit it remained a manifestation of anti-science gibberish. By definition, science is, or should be, an apolitical process. Scientific truths and natural laws exist independent of researchers' identities. The distribution of prime numbers does not change as a function of whether the mathematician is a white, heterosexual Christian man or a transgendered, Muslim, differently sized, obese individual. The periodic table of elements is not dependent on whether a chemist is a Latinx queer or a cisnormative Hasidic Jew. Oh, you're a non-binary bisexual chemist? Well, this completely changes the atomic numbers of carbon, palladium, and uranium. All satire aside, science is liberating precisely because it does not care about your identity. It is the epistemological means by which we seek to understand the world using evidentiary rules that are unbiased. There is no other game in town, no other way of knowing. This leads me to another virulent mind pathogen that has spread within the university ecosystem: the idea that science is a white colonial way of knowing. In fall 2016, South African students at the University of Cape Town, known as Fallists, who believe science must fall, gained worldwide attention when they argued that it was imperative to decolonize one's mind from the shackles of white colonial science. Sorry, Albert Einstein, Charles Darwin, Isaac Newton, and Galileo Galilei, you are not people of color. Your work cannot be fully trusted. Back to the drawing boards. Readers might be tempted to think that this is hardly something to worry about. After all, the South African quacks in question are undoubtedly an anomaly. Surely this form of anti-science idiocy could not spread. Or could it? There is a growing push across Canadian universities to indigenize the curricula. This is meant as a conciliatory response to past historical grievances against the Indigenous people. According to such a view, the scientific method is only one of many ways of knowing. Other forms of knowing, including those that might belong within the folklore and mythology of Indigenous people, are peddled as equally valid forms of discovery. I'm here to tell you that, no, they're not. Of course, Indigenous people do have unique insight about the flora and fauna of lands on which they've lived for generations, and it is perfectly reasonable to presume that such content-specific local knowledge is extremely valuable and worthy of learning and sharing. However, the manner by which scientific information is codified within the pantheon of human knowledge is not culture-specific. Patrick Beauchesne, a Quebec deputy minister, was recently severely rebuked for daring to question how Indigenous knowledge might be evaluated against scientific knowledge when conducting environmental impact studies. Apparently, he was guilty of supporting a, quote, hierarchy of knowledges. The scientific method is the universal epistemological framework for understanding the world around us. Science does not care about the privileged position of ancestral wisdom, tribal knowledge, and the ways of the elders. There are no revealed truths in science. There is no Lebanese Jewish way of knowing, any more than there is an Indigenous way of knowing. All claims about the natural world must pass through the evidentiary prism of the scientific method. There are several other ways by which the indigenization of academia is taking place. Indigenous land acknowledgement statements are often made at the start of formal academic events, such as graduation ceremonies, wherein speakers start off by acknowledging that the attendees are on hallowed grounds whose provenance belongs to Indigenous people. A more forceful version of this new ritual is to proclaim that the attendees are trespassing on stolen lands. In fall 2017, I delivered an invited lecture at the University of Regina titled Death of the West by a Thousand Cuts, Forces that Impede the Free and Rational Exchange of Ideas. The introducer began by reminding the audience of Treaty 6, signed between the Canadian Crown and various Indigenous peoples in 1876, and added that we were on the lands of the Métis. At university convocations, masters of ceremony will often start off by making such land acknowledgments. Put yourself in the shoes of the thousands of graduating students who must sit silently while having the cloak of historical guilt placed on their shoulders. They have worked hard for many years to arrive to this point. This is their moment. It is their time in the spotlight. And yet, they are catapulted into historical grievances that have nothing to do with any of them. The reality is that innumerable existing lands have belonged to someone else at some point. This is a defining feature of history. It is an indelible part of Homo sapiens. Should we adopt a global standard wherein any and all ceremonies must begin with a forensic historical accounting of all peoples who laid claim to a given land? If so, Jews should insist that all future events that take place in Saudi Arabia start off by recognizing the historical rights of the Banu Nadir, the Banu Kenuka, and the Banu Qurayza, Jewish tribes that existed in the region prior to the ascent of Islam. The indigenization process is not restricted to university curricula and university ceremonies. It has attacked the fundamental means by which academic works are evaluated, namely the peer review process. It might be worthwhile to step back and briefly explain how it works. Academic journals are managed by an editor-in-chief, associate editors, at times, and an editorial board of academic experts in the field in question. The peer review process begins when the editor receives a paper for consideration and quickly establishes whether it is of the necessary quality and within the focus of the journal. If these conditions are not met, the editor will, quote, desk reject the paper, which means he will not send it out for review. Otherwise, a suitable number of reviewers are sent the paper for their academic evaluations. Usually, this consists of two or three experts from the editorial board, but at times the editor might ask an expert who does not sit on the board to review the paper. This is known as an ad hoc reviewer. Once all reviews are submitted to the editor, a decision letter is sent to the authors with typically one of four possibilities. The journal will, 1, accept the paper, 2, ask the authors to make minor revisions and resubmit the paper, 3, ask the authors to make major revisions and resubmit the paper, or 4, reject the paper. This process can go on for several rounds of review, consisting of several years of intense expert scrutiny. As such, once a paper is published in the academic literature, it has typically gone through an extensive evaluation. Peer review is hardly perfect. Great papers are at times rejected, poor papers are accepted. But it is a necessary and integral element of the vetting of human knowledge. It might surprise you to know that it is a racist process, despite the fact that it is typically double-blind. Reviewers and authors do not know one another's identities. This was the claim made by University of British Columbia law professor Lorna June McHugh in 2016. Specifically, McHugh, who is an Indigenous woman, asserted that peer-reviewed works were incongruent with the oral traditions of her heritage, and as such, the university was being discriminatory against her ancestry. Astonishingly, her case was heard in front of the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal, and it decided that the university had not discriminated against Professor McHugh. Someone should have advised all Jewish Nobel laureates long ago that they did not have to bother writing things down, since Judaism also stems from a rich oral tradition. The contemporary progressive mantra considers it laudable to argue that different races, cultures, or religions possess distinct ways of knowing. However, not too long ago, the idea that people of different races or classes possessed distinct ways of thinking and reasoning was reserved for racists and other miscreants. Ludwig von Mises, a leading figure of the Austrian School of Economics and a staunch defender of classical liberalism, coined the term polylogism to capture this exact folly. Mises differentiated between Marxian polylogism and racial polylogism. In the former case, an individual's method of thinking was determined by his social class, while in the latter case, race was the guiding factor. Mises was well aware of the illogical nature of this premise when he remarked, "A consistent supporter of polylogism would have to maintain that ideas are correct because their author is a member of the right class, nation, or race. But consistency is not one of their virtues. Thus, the Marxians are prepared to assign the epithet proletarian thinker to everybody whose doctrines they approve. All the others they disparage either as foes of their class or as social traitors." Current social justice warriors engage in similar ideological thinking. "I disagree with you" is thus replaced with disparaging labels: climate change denier, white nationalist, new atheist, white supremacist, alt-right, and so on, demonizing dissenters from progressive orthodoxy as nefarious and evil. Polylogism is an anti-science notion, as Mises well knew. Mises had highlighted the wider significance of polylogism, characterizing it as a romantic revolt against logic and science, and pointing out that it does not limit itself to the sphere of social phenomena and the sciences of human action. It is a revolt against our entire culture and civilization. The scientific method liberates us to pursue truth regardless of who we are. Similarly, evolutionary psychology, a discipline viscerally despised by many progressives, is expressly anti-racist in that it recognizes that underneath many of our surface differences, human minds were born of the same evolutionary forces irrespective of our racial or ethnic backgrounds. Environmental forces, or culture, do affect our thinking styles, reasoning, and decision-making, but these effects are not immutable elements of one's race or ethnicity. There is no black mind or white mind, no white male way of knowing or indigenous way of knowing. There is only one truth, and we find it through the scientific method. The ideological conformity of diversity, inclusion, and equity. Progressives seem to believe that if they say the words diversity, inclusion, and equity often enough, all problems will be solved. But of course, only certain types of diversity, inclusion, and equity matter. Diversity based on race, ethnicity, religion, sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity are foundational sacraments in the cult of diversity. On the other hand, intellectual and political diversity are heretical ideas that need to be expunged. If Saudi Arabia's state religion is Islam, the official quasi-religion of Western universities is diversity, inclusion, and equity, or DI for short. An ever-growing number of academic administrators are hired to ensure that the DI cult reigns supreme. Mark J. Perry, a professor of economics at the University of Michigan, Flint, has estimated that the University of Michigan has 93 employees on its payroll to uphold the tenets of DI for a total yearly cost of more than $11 million. The top DI administrator within that list receives a yearly compensation of $396,550, more than the combined salary of four faculty members at most American universities. Bloated administrative payrolls are already a disastrous financial reality at most universities. Adding endless DI bureaucrats is only making it worse. In the never-ending need to uncover illusory racists lurking in every crevasse, members of the DI cult have benefited from the use of the Implicit Association Test, IAT, which is supposed to measure people's latent biases. In other words, even when you proclaim that you are not a racist and have never harbored a single racist thought in your life, the IAT will prove otherwise. It is similar to the infamous principle of Lavrenti Beria, head of Joseph Stalin's secret police: show me the man and I'll find you the crime. In this case, show me the person, undoubtedly a heterosexual white Christian male, and the IAT will show you a hateful racist. The reality is that the IAT has a very poor predictive validity. Diversity training based on identifying supposed unconscious biases is likely ineffectual, and the IAT's scientific value continues to be a hotly debated topic, so it is grossly imprudent to use it in corporate and educational settings as though it were settled science. But the DI zealots insist that all those under their dominion must be full converts to the progressive faith. A growing number of universities now require, as part of the faculty hiring and promotion process, that one demonstrates adherence to DI principles. Take, for example, UCLA's Office of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. It released a report explaining that faculty members should submit a statement, as part of the standard evaluation of academic personnel, wherein they highlight their, quote, past, present, and future planned contributions to equity, diversity, and inclusion, unquote. In the same way that Ba'ath Party members swore their allegiance to former dictator Saddam Hussein, and North Koreans publicly sang with great fervor their undying love for their now deceased, albeit glorious, dear leader Kim Jong-il, academic personnel must now prostrate themselves at the altar of DI. Failure to do so might bring the death of one's academic career. Let me share a personal anecdote that speaks to this growing reality. I was contacted by a female student, who happened to be an apparent fan of my work, who was a member of the John Molson Women in Business Club. They were interested in inviting me to speak at an event about how men could serve as allies to women in the workplace. I held a Skype chat with the woman to learn more about the session. She told me she wanted me to share strategies that I might have used in my career to support and advance women. I reminded her that I treat each person with equal dignity, irrespective of their sex, or other immutable characteristics, and that I have always judged people based on their individual merits. I also pointed out that the dean of our business school is a woman, as is the associate dean of research. Since holding my chat with her, our department has appointed a woman as our chairperson. I conceded that women had faced discrimination in the past, but pointed out that the current situation is very different, as the data show that women are currently doing quite well vis-a-vis men and are surpassing them in many academic fields. Instead of promoting a false victimhood narrative, I offered to deliver a lecture on my scientific research on sex differences. The committee decided against inviting me. I could have played along and delivered the requested lecture on the need for men to be better allies to women, but my commitment to truth and adherence to reality meant I could not do so in good conscience, because it is terribly condescending and patronizing to pretend that women need men to serve as their allies. This is a form of infantilism that should not exist in a meritocratic system. But of course, in academic institutions, it reigns supreme. Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, has stated that before accepting a speaking engagement, he would examine the conference's commitment to eradicating all male panels. To my chagrin, his position was endorsed by Simon Baron Cohen, a leading cognitive neuroscientist. The virtue signaling of such high-profile male, quote, allies, should really be seen as an insult to female scientists who do not need to be coddled and protected from meritocratic standards. They do not need so-called affirmative action. Totalitarian ideologies insist on conformity, and there are many ways to impose a herd mindset on a population. Take, for example, the imposition of sartorial norms in Mao Zedong's Communist China, or within the ultra-Orthodox Hasidic sects. Everyone looks the same. To stand out as an individual is to explicitly proclaim that you are more important than the collective. How do the Dai bureaucrats impose conformity? In the academic world, you are free to dress as you'd like, but your thoughts and beliefs are subject to the intellectual conformity of the progressive ideology. Numerous studies have explored professors' political affiliations, and the findings are truly astonishing. A 2005 study conducted across 11 California universities uncovered a 5-to-1 Democrat to Republican ratio. Perhaps not surprisingly, the most lopsided ratio was that of UC Berkeley, 8.7-to-1 ratio. When broken down by departments across universities, 39 out of 42 listed fields had a greater ratio of Democrat professors. Not surprisingly, fields laden with social justice activism were the most lopsided. Sociology had a 44-to-1 ratio. In a 2016 study of professors' voting registration at 40 leading American universities across 5 disciplines, the Democrat to Republican ratios were 4.5, economics, 33.5, history, 20.0, journalism, 8.6, law, and 17.4, psychology. The total across the 5 disciplines was an 11.5-to-1 ratio favoring Democratic professors. A detailed examination of law professors at American universities found that only 15% were classified as conservative, based on data from political donations, and the liberal lopsidedness was differentially acute across legal subspecialties. As might be expected, legal specializations laden with social justice activists were ranked as the most liberal. These were, in decreasing order, feminist legal theory, poverty law, women and the law, critical race theory, immigration law, and disability law. Finally, a recent study of professors' political registrations at 51 out of the 60 top liberal arts colleges in the United States uncovered a 10.4-to-1 Democrat to Republican ratio. If the 2 outlier military colleges are removed, the ratio increases to 12.7-to-1. Incredibly, 20 institutions had a proportion of Republican professors that, statistically speaking, was 0. Of note, the more prestigious a school is, the more lopsided the Democrat ratio, 21.5, 12.8, 12.4, and 6.9 across tiers 1, 2, 3, and 4, respectively. The economist Thomas Sowell, who happens to be one of the original slayers of social justice warriors back in the 1960s and 1970s, famously quipped, "The next time some academics tell you how important diversity is, ask how many Republicans there are in their sociology department." Samuel J. Abrams, a professor of politics at ultra-liberal Sarah Lawrence College, recently penned a New York Times opinion piece wherein he reported his survey findings of 900 administrators tasked with the management of student life on campuses. He found that the ratio of liberals to conservatives among this group was 12 to 1, well in line with similar skewed ratios for the professoriate. In his closing paragraph, he opined, "This warped ideological distribution among college administrators should give our students and their families pause. To students who are in their first semester at school, I urge you not to accept unthinkingly what your campus administrators are telling you. Their ideological imbalance, coupled with their agenda-setting power, threatens the free and open exchange of ideas, which is precisely what we need to protect in higher education in these politically polarized times." This is a plainly sensible position, and yet the hysterical reaction from students and staff at his college was what we've come to expect from these adult toddlers. Threatening and insulting notes were left outside his office, demanding that he first apologize and then resign. The college's president accused him of lacking compassion and of making people, quote, feel unsafe on campus. Whenever I discuss studies that document the extreme liberal bias on university campuses, I am invariably told, professors are educated, intellectually sophisticated, and smart, so of course they are liberal. It's a self-selection bias. Intelligent people are liberal. Universities are comprised of intelligent people, therefore, most of them are inevitably liberal. Self-selection, however, is not what drives the liberal bias on university campuses, but rather systemic politically based discrimination. A study of social and personality psychologists documented the paucity of conservative faculty members, only 6% of the surveyed sample. Of note, a sizable number of faculty members admitted that they would discriminate against conservative colleagues when reviewing their papers or grant applications, when deciding whether to invite them to a symposium, and when making hiring decisions. The more, quote, liberal a faculty member was, the more likely he was to endorse this sort of brazen discrimination. Given the rampant discriminatory bias against them, is it any surprise that conservative students and professors feel unwelcome in the academy, and that most conservative graduate students and faculty members are likely to hide their political leanings? The, quote, academics are smart and hence they are liberals premise is faulty for a second reason. The implicit but erroneous implication is that conservatives are largely science deniers. But science denialism is found amongst liberals at least as much as it is amongst conservatives. Yes, some conservatives reject evolution for religious reasons, but many progressives reject evolutionary psychology because it contradicts many of their secular ideologies, including radical feminism. The human instinct to protect one's beliefs from the indignity of being challenged transcends an individual's political orientation. It is a frailty of the human spirit, and as such, it is not restricted to liberals or conservatives. Few people possess the intellectual courage to expose their most cherished positions to opposing perspectives. The human ego is brittle and frail. The, quote, academics are smart and hence they are liberals, canard, is devastatingly wrong for a third, but equally important reason. If a conservative ecology professor rejects the theory of evolution, a scientific truth that is as incontrovertible as the existence of gravity, this is obviously a problem. One's political or religious beliefs cannot supersede accepted scientific knowledge, though we must remember that such knowledge remains provisional and open to falsification. But there are many issues on which there can be conflicting, yet perfectly reasonable and valid positions that lend themselves to debate. What should a country's foreign, fiscal, and immigration policies look like? What are the pros and cons of the death penalty? Is universal health care a viable and sustainable program? There are countless issues of substantive, political, societal, and economic importance where university students stand to benefit greatly from being exposed to a heterogeneity of perspectives. Hence, the quest for greater intellectual diversity is not some theoretically abstract ideal. Diversity of thought on campus helps train future leaders to weigh different outlooks and opinions and facts in making a sound judgment. Intellectual diversity is the engine that allows for the Darwinian process of competition to select the best ideas, what we call evolutionary epistemology. In this sense, universities today have become anti-Darwinian cesspools of barren ideological conformity. It is important to note that the lack of intellectual and political diversity is not restricted to academia. Ideological conformity is rampant across every key industry that deals in information. An analysis of political campaign donations across a broad range of industries uncovered that the four most liberal professions, in decreasing order, were the entertainment industry, academia, online computer services, and newspapers and print media. These professions were much more liberal than conservative professions were conservative. In other words, political bias is asymmetric. These general findings were confirmed in another study of political leanings based on political contributions across professions. For example, the film and stage production industry had a 93-7 Democrat to Republican ratio. Editors in the book and magazine publishing industry had a 92-8 Democrat to Republican ratio. Academia had a 90-10 Democrat to Republican ratio. An examination of midterm political contributions of $200 or more by employees who work in the technology industry uncovered an astronomical liberal bias. The percentage of contributions that went to Democratic candidates from Netflix was 99.6%, from Twitter, 98.6%,